So my name's Alison Wright. So I was Alison Tete before I got married. I was Alison Blundell. I did a bachelor's in chemistry and management science, and I went to the careers advisor, and she recommended, after doing her test, that I apply to IBM, and Dow Chemicals and ICI. So I applied to all of them, and IBM offered me a job as a systems engineer, whereby they train you, sort of over a year, year and a half, because I didn't have any IT experience. But they liked chemists because of the systems thinking that's involved in chemistry, which is similar to in computing. It was the late 80s. So 88 to 91, I was in with IBM UK. It was exciting, the whole process of being selected, because they did the selection in one day. And they started with 120 odd people to begin with, and they ended up with a dozen that they gave a job to. And we were offered the job at the end of the day. So by the end of the day, you knew you had the job. And the job involved, the training initially involved doing a lot of just reading and then going to workshops and role play, an awful lot of role playing. I was associated to a senior, we were each associated to a senior systems engineer. And so basically we went with them to their meetings. Now we were working for DM, Distribution Marketing, which was the sales force behind the PCs. And this is just the late 80s, is just the beginning of the PC revolution. So the systems engineer I was associated to, he was responsible for several large PC dealerships that were based in London, and I tagged along to his meetings. I got fairly bored fairly quickly. I didn't really, really enjoy it. The office was a bit of a ghost town as well. We were working in this huge office in Chiswick, and there weren't many people there, and I was doing a lot of driving up and down to Basingstoke because my manager was based in Basingstoke, and I rolled my car on a journey back from Basingstoke one day. By going too fast on a corner coming off the motorway. It really made me think, oh, is this really what I want to be doing in my life? And I decided not. So I resigned. Now, before I went to do my degree, I had traveled for a year. My brother was a headmaster of a senior, junior secondary school in Botswana. So I went and visited him in this village, Malnatala, and lived there and did a bit of teaching at his school, just as voluntary work, and did a lot of traveling around. Anyway, I'd obviously fallen in love with Botswana, and even my parents actually went there, and they lived there for a couple of years too, so I had plenty of opportunity to go back and forth. And so when I decided to leave IBM, I thought, well, I'll go to Botswana and see if I can get a job there. Now, I really wasn't particularly enchanted by IT per se. And really, what I'd wanted to do was be a journalist. So I tried, first of all, to get a job in journalism in Botswana. But I was quickly brought up short that, citizens can do that role. And I had no experience. So that was a non-runner. But the Government Computer Bureau was an option. So I went to the Government Computer Bureau and they offered me a job. But it was on a local salary, which wasn't really going to be enough to be able to rent the sort of property I'd like to have rented. So I went to the dealerships to see what they were doing. I visited all of the dealerships and ended up with I that I went to the IBM dealership called Business Computers Botswana, and they offered me a job in sales at the salary that I'd left IBM UK on. And that's what I went for. Now, within a couple of years, IBM, the government of Botswana, started a new development plan 6-year development program, and within that they had £100 million worth put aside for projects relating to computerization of government systems. Now, this was obviously a huge opportunity, and so the director and owner of Business Computers Botswana, who was himself an ex-IBMer, Ernest Zebron, he approached IBM to see if they would like to buy BCB and set up IBM Botswana. And that's what IBM World Trade Organization did. They bought BCB and it was established. Now, on establishment, they brought in a management team, a senior management team, principally of Danes. Jürgen Beer as the general manager, Per Meigind as the sort of systems engineer, Preben Due Thompson, I can't even remember what he purported to do, and Søren Lauesen, who was Per's doer in terms of writing software and setting up the schedules and all of that sort of thing. Anyway, so during this time, I was selling to the government of Botswana. Now, they had a team of consultants who were managing the procurement for the government of Botswana. So these consultants essentially became my customers. I was talking to them, taking them on site visits. When I was doing the proposal, they were writing the statement of user requirements to which I would respond in proposals for what the systems that we were selling could do. And there's a lot of business that I stayed up very late working with the team, writing proposals for that we didn't ever get. But the business that we did get was all of the Department of Public Service Management business, which is implementing a new HR system. And the system was applicable to the whole of government, so every single ministry.
In layman's terms, this is the whole of the personnel system for the whole of the Botswana government.
Yes, and the performance management and everything sort of basically ran through this. Stores, supplies, they all interfaced with the system. And we also sold it to the Botswana police force. Now, because of separation of duties, they weren't in the initial tranche that covered that project. But somehow we managed to forget about separation of duties and go ahead and implement it within the Botswana police force as well. Not only that, I sold the Botswana police force the sort of add-ons that enable them to do crime reporting. So I got to learn a lot about crime reporting systems and their drawbacks from the police force, because the Botswana police force was saying, you know, hey, the problem with this system is it's really easy to constrain the system so that people can't report certain sorts of crime. And I can remember, you know, doing my best to handle that conflict, but basically saying, oh no, you know, you have to put in systems to make sure that doesn't happen. But that's essentially what I've found has happened to our crime reporting systems here. It's impossible to report fraud, and certainly the sort of fraud I'm trying to call out. So, yes.
Now, I mean, from what you're saying there seems to be quite a close relationship between the people selling these computer systems and the people doing the procuring.
Even closer than that, because after all of this, just as I left the country, or even in fact when I was back in the UK, I found out that the consultants who I was selling to, who were my customers, they had all been sourced via PricewaterhouseCoopers Botswana from a company called Stibo Systems. And when that senior management team left Botswana, which was a year after startup, I became aware then that they were consultants from Stibo Systems, because I prepared the payment to Stibo Systems for their services. When they had arrived, I had been under the false assumption that they were from IBM. This was an IBM senior management team, but that was not, that was an obfuscation of the truth. So it means that, yeah, the customers to whom I was selling were from the same company that were the managers of the startup of IBM Botswana, which describes a circular relationship, which is fraudulent.
Well, I mean, this is maybe the journalist in you coming out, understanding these things and how important they were. What year are we talking about here?
Well, I was in Botswana between 1992 and 2002, so 10 years. And the DPSM project lasted over several years, and yeah, six or 7 years. And I spent the last 3 years, 2 years, working with Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Merck and the African Comprehensive HIV/AIDS Program, implementing systems for a rollout of antiretroviral therapies nationwide.
So how did you make this transition to doing this kind of pharmaceutical stuff?
Well, I was just a salesperson, so the government was my customer, and whichever ministry of the government needed a solution, I was the person that coordinated the delivery, the development of the solution.
What's your take on the role of these pharmaceutical companies down in that part of the world?
Well, because they acquired the business fraudulently, you can only assume the worst, basically, because the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation deal, I found out right at the end, IBM had provided the money to Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that they were providing to the government of Botswana to buy the systems that I was selling. Another circular deal. So this is a tried and tested method of fraud.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's fraudulent, but it's also, there's a lot of politics intertwined with all of this, because, I mean, as we know, after the Second World War, many of these African countries, the Western European countries that had been colonial powers, divested, moved out, these countries so-called became independent. But it sounds to me like you're talking about a form of neo-colonialism that nobody's supposed to notice.
Yes, and with the complicity of the government as well. I think there's some complicity within the actual government of Botswana. Certain that they were aware. I have memories of things that stood out as being unusual or not quite right, or throwaway comments that people have made that now I'm reflecting on and I have a different sort of understanding of. But for example, when I went to meet the permanent secretary of health for the first time, Mr. Chakalisa, the woman who was his secretary, when I got there a little bit early and I was trying to ask her questions about him, just background, and because I was asking probing questions, she said, to tell you the truth, I don't know. He's an actor. He's not even from Botswana. Now, and then he arrived, so I never got to follow it up. But he seemed real enough to me, and there were Chakalisas that lived in the country, and I couldn't see you know, I thought she must have been joking, basically. But it may be that he was a fly-in actor playing that role, and I actually signed the contracts with him.
Yeah, I suppose many people in Africa would, if they knew about this, would rather resent this idea. And also, of course, there may be pushback by some individuals, as I think there was in the 1950s and 60s. Some African leaders and 70s started pushing back against this form of, arm's length colonialism, financial colonialism, industrial colonialism, and some of them came to sticky ends. But anyway, what about coming a little bit more into history? Because IBM as a company has a very checkered record. We had a fraudulent deal with them here in the Avon and Somerset Police, where the chief constable had actually arranged for a contract, personal contract, that he privately benefited from with IBM. That was... after a few years and a new chief constable, they got rid of that system. But I know IBM were actually involved a bit with the Nazis too, weren't they?
Yes, they were. And in fact, my manager told me some intricate detail of what IBM's role in the Holocaust was. IBM had in those days the Hollerith machines, which were punch card machines. And IBM Germany won the contract to run the census in Germany just before the war. So IBM had all the data on everybody's their family history. And IBM leased all the solutions to Hitler and the Third Reich that they used in the concentration camps. So they had Hollerith machines running in the concentration camps, and the tattoos on people's arm was the code from their data card, which held their census details.
Yeah, so this was a sort of early kind of computer where a lot of the data wasn't held digitally. It was in the form of a card, quite a sort of tough individual card with little holes punched in it, which could then be fed through a kind of calculator machine, which would do basically the same job as a computer now does digitally.
Yes, yes. These are the first computers, really. And they're used for managing, much as we use them today, for managing human resources. So the very first HR systems, if you like, were developed on these eight Hollerith machines and used with grim consequences and through the Holocaust. And IBM was also responsible for train scheduling, and they had the contracts for train scheduling across Europe. So it was they that managed the trains to enable the flow of people.
I mean, in what sort of mood and context was he telling you these things? I mean, I suppose when you join a big company like that, you know, you're kind of overwhelmed a bit with the prestige of being part of something big. But then, I mean, how did he tell you about it, and how did you take it?
When I first became the general manager and Carsten became my boss, he asked me then to set up an appointment at Arapa Diamond Mine, which is a good 3 or 4 hour drive from the city. There was a delay of several months before I actually did that, but it was on that journey. So I was driving and he was telling me his version of history when he told me all about what IBM had done during the Holocaust. I was driving up to Arapa. My manager's name was Carsten Schoenborn. Schoenborn. He was based in Vienna, Austria, and he was responsible for all of IBM's operations in Africa. So he rarely visited the actual country, but he was my co-director when I became general manager and director of IBM Botswana. On this journey, he told me a lot of things. So I'll try to start at the beginning, which is where he started. He said, I'm going to start with Adam and Eve, which I found pretty shocking. He was saying how the Bible captures the history, if you like, the story of Adam and Eve and their descendants. The story starts with Eve committing what's described as a sin. It can be taken as a crime against natural law. And the Bible is careful not to tell you exactly what it is, but it gives alliterations or such as the apple, the fruit of the tree of life. He said the key to understanding what Eve's sin was is given in the Hail Mary, in that prayer, in the line, blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. It equates fruit of the womb to a baby. And that's the unnatural act that Eve committed. And with that act, she discovered that the ingestion of young tissues, young DNA, physically repairs the DNA of the imbiber. It repairs, as he explained, the telomere caps. So the actual, the new DNA that's created is younger, because the aging as a result of the telomere caps becoming faulty, and so the DNA it's generating having errors, and it's those errors that are the lines and the signs of aging. You imbibe young DNA, it repairs the DNA, and the person literally transforms into looking younger again. Now, this was the discovery that enabled her and her descendants to live as if forever, eternal. He said to think of them as a virus, a parasitic perversion of natural law. Now, he said that it had advantages because, many advantages, since it enabled the discovery of and the development of the tree of knowledge through learning, longevity, repeated observation and developing scientific methods, and it was an accelerated process by using young tissues to prolong their life. He cantered, galloped through history, putting history into the context of that piece of information. Through time, the development of slave trade as being obviously the source that they used. It's easy to divert children out of those flows of people. Ownership of all the big companies, buying up any new companies that had any bright ideas. They could keep control of basically everything. And then when the decision was to conceal the slave trade and make it illegal, they basically concealed it within the processes of existing trade so that it could go on, but it was no longer visible. And he said that was enabled because they would act as consultants for the new systems that were being developed to by the customs, etc., to in order to audit and capture that sort of behaviour. They designed those as well so that it could go on unimpeded. Does that make sense?
I suppose so. I mean, it's obviously a long time since you really thought about this, and it all sort of popped back into your mind around 2020. How sure are you that you've got, you know, proper recall of what he was saying?
Very sure. It's stuff I've not heard anywhere else, and things that I would never have thought of myself.
He said that the Holocaust should more rightly be thought of as an industrial revolution because it was a cartel that managed it of the pharmaceutical companies, the banks, IBM, and train companies. And the context, well, he was essentially telling me that the plans were in place for it all to happen again in a fourth industrial revolution.
Okay, so I mean, this is rather worrying, isn't it? The idea that you're a part of some business and you find out that actually it's closely connected to the Holocaust in not necessarily a critical way, in a money-making fashion, and plans to do the same again. I mean, how did you feel when you got out of the car at the end of the journey?
At the time that he told me all of this, it was just too shocking to hold in my brain, so I had to close it away. Forget it, and that's what I did. But I didn't remember any of this until about 2020. So yeah. When I started to recall, I was appalled, frightened, and I started sending statements into the police, here, the local Sussex police. They responded by sending me for a psychiatric assessment, which I attended in Brighton. And I was questioned by a psychiatrist, a psychotherapist, and somebody else. But however, they seemed to find that I certainly believed that I'd heard what I was telling them. And if what I had heard was true, then they were quite frightened.
Well, yeah, I mean, so how do you see COVID now in that context?
So, because this all coincided with that same timing. So when I saw them, it was outside with masks on. So I was trying to put the coronavirus overreach into perspective for them. But coronaviruses have always existed, and they always mutate every year several times. And that year it had a particularly nasty bite. I know I had a bad, I was quite poorly around that time, end of 2019. But it was being used deliberately to justify using these mRNA vaccines so that would enable the precedent to be set for using mRNA for other uses as well, for other vaccines. So it's a pure money spinner and control mechanism. Good excuse for bringing in control of the individuals. If you recall what happened in the Holocaust, is first of all, they asset stripped the victims. And I see that very much as a phase that we're going in through nationally, internationally right now, individuals being asset stripped and forced to relinquish their freedom, rather like we were forced to relinquish our freedom through COVID.
I mean, I'd like to say, first of all, that it's gaslighting you, really, sending you for a psychiatric test. Also, of course, the police, the senior police, look more to their future careers and their jobs than they do to upholding the law. And that we've got something called the Crown and the Crown Prosecution Service, run actually, and you know, judges, etc., chief constables are appointed by the royal family, which is not really in any way, you know, you can't vote them in or out. So we have a kind of rigid criminal justice system. But I just wonder, from your experience, Alison, what it's taught you about coping mechanisms, really, for this, because there's quite a lot of people out there who do feel that not only with it, you know, are these things like the war with Russia. I mean, I can't imagine many young people wanting to sign up for that. And trade wars around the world sort of starting up now. What sort of coping mechanisms there are for realising that actually your government might not be there to help you, but the opposite?
My coping mechanisms have been, first of all, to stick to making sure the people I love and who I have time with are happy, safe, well cared for and loved. So keeping up all the routines of life while you try to sort out what's gone wrong is very important, so that you can enjoy life and that you can have downtime. So that's one thing. And then what I've been doing is working, dedicating all of my spare time to a strategy which I hope will bring this to the public, which has been, in my case, through writing these compliance assessments of MPs, lords and baronesses, and business leaders and businesses. I mean, the situation could be described as a coup within our government, that a cartel has assumed positions of control throughout our government. And when I was in Botswana, I got married, and Dorte, my husband, he died in 2000 of AIDS. His father was a lawyer. He was Ghanaian, and he'd been the acting attorney general in Ghana during a coup. So he was a lawyer at the time of the coup, but he spotted how they were getting away with it legally and dedicated, I don't know how much time, but more than a year or two, of writing, preparing the evidence of what they were doing. And then eventually he was able to submit that and get arrests, which brought down the coup, and he became the acting attorney general who managed the trying of the people that had been involved in the coup. Subsequent to that, he left Ghana and he went to Botswana. So he was the assistant attorney general in Botswana, and he was drafting the law reports. And I used to spend a lot of time with him. I then had children, and when the children were small, they used to go to their grandparents during the daytime whilst I was working. So I meet them every evening. And Uncle Coffee is his name. Uncle Coffee's friends, he had friends internationally who would visit, and I would get to meet them. The circuit judges, High Court circuit judges, were some of them were his friends, so I got to meet them every time they came, once a year or so. Anyway, their favourite conversation was how to bring a coup down, how to recognise it, how to spot it, how to build the evidence base, how to confront it. So what I've been doing is putting into action the advice that I heard back then from these very senior judges.
Wow. I don't know if you've come across this Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars document, because it echoes a lot of what you're saying about systems analysis and this whole idea of a kind of techno-slavery. But that, what you're saying does sort of tally with that. I think that was discovered in the United States somewhere. Someone had been photocopying it and they found it in the photocopy, and no one really knew where it was coming from.
Yes, and it was found in an IBM photocopier, or at IBM, I think.
Mm. Yeah, so there are definitely some echoes in potential truth. I mean, we have to also, I think, add that Carsten could have been just throwing complete nonsense at you to mix with the truth, to see, you know, what you would believe and what you wouldn't believe. And this is a technique that these people use. But anyway, I know you wanted to also to talk about your work today. So this is about not so much about the bad guys, but it's also about how we can deal with them.
Well, yeah. So what I've been doing is that I've been doing these compliance assessments of figures who are in politics, in House of Lords, etc. And what I found is that there's a couple of loopholes in the company's house system that they're exploiting to conceal interests, which, if they were made explicit, would prevent some transactions going through. So it enables money laundering, people trafficking, and terrorism funding. So it dodges the laws that are in place to stop that. So what they do is register more than one identity in company's house, and then an auditor or KYC software that's looking at any one identity doesn't know about the interests held in the other identity. Now, it can be an accident, and you never make use of it, of the fact, it's a way of that you could conceal potentially income from HMRC, because you could send them one identity, whereas you have all of your other interests are in the other identity, and those are the ones you don't declare. And then the other thing that's going on is companies dissolving without doing final accounts. Now, that's a breach of the Companies Act as well. So having multiple identities is a breach of the Companies Act, Section 108(2), and dissolving companies without producing final accounts is also an offence. Now, the risk is that you maintain dormant bank accounts, or ostensibly dormant bank accounts, in that company's name that you can still use, again, for money laundering, or to conceal money from the authorities. So I've been successfully in getting several of the peers investigated by the Commissioner for Standards, the Lords Commissioner for Standards, a man called Martin Jelly. And so he's done, I think it's 5 or 6 reports on different people. They're all up on the House of Lords Complaints website. And then about 4 weeks ago, I noticed that they're about to change the code of conduct, the House of Lords Code of Conduct, and the changes that they're making to that with regards to the Register of Interest will mean that they stop having to declare their, what they term, non-financial interests, their charity interests. Now, this is where I'm finding all of the problems occurring, is quite often within the charity's interests. So the changes they're making to their code of conduct is sort of to circumvent, in some ways, the complaints that I've been raising. So, right, well, let me do a compliance assessment on all of the members of the conduct committee that have put in for these changes. And that's what's been keeping me busy for the last month or so, is doing these audits. And I've just got to the point where I'm getting back to Lord Evans. And Baroness Manningham Buller is the chair of the conduct committee. And she's got errors in her register of interest. For example, she was a director of what is now called ARC Data Centres. It was previously called ARC something else, I can't remember the name now, but she didn't update it in her register of interest. Now, by not updating it in her register of interest means that her association to ARC Data Centres won't be flagged in audits and KYC checks. And then another of the lords at ARC Data Centre is Lord Evans, and he also has multiple identities and didn't declare it properly. But then when I go and look at the directors of ARC Data Centres, well, one of the secretary, father, the officers of Park Data Centre, the secretary is a man called Perminder Tony Singh. Now, I knew Tony Singh. Tony Singh did all of the configurations for me, all the technical configuration of this complex hardware that I was buying for the government of Botswana. I was ordering on behalf of the government of Botswana. So Tony Singh, who worked late into the night many times with me on the phone, getting the configurations right for the equipment that we supplied to the government of Botswana for the big contracts that I did win, he is also the secretary of the UK ARC Data Centres. And the occurrence and the recurrence of ARC ARC, which is also used by the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship, Sir Paul Marshall, and ARC ARK is also used by him or his co-director, McCormick, for ARC Absolute Return for Kids, ARC. Essentially, I think I'm finding the clone company fraud is when you have two similarly named companies that you can switch transaction between, again, to dodge anti-money laundering and terrorism financing laws. So I'm pretty sure, as I'm doing these assessments of the Conduct Committee, our present Conduct Committee of the House of Lords, who've just made changes to the Code of Conduct that worsen transparency and conceal interest. The changes, I would argue, are breach the Companies Act. But they've come into force. They came into force on Saturday, on 5th of April. So over the weekend, I put in complaints against Baroness Manning and Buller, and I've got three more that are about to go in. I've published the ones that I put in on Saturday, because what happens is, as soon as they accept that my complaint is legitimate, I'm then sent a letter saying, you know, I'm not allowed to discuss it. And that's what happened to me when...
What? You can't discuss it? Why not?
Because it could jeopardize the investigation. I can't remember which section it is, but so that's what happened to me with Labour Together. I did one on Labour Together, and I couldn't publish it for about 6 weeks until he'd published his report on whichever Lord it was I was calling out.
Well, say something about Labour Together, because they're a very interesting little group, aren't they?
Yeah, so we'll look on my website, because I've done a full report on them. And do you know who I mean by Alliance Responsible Citizenship? They a couple of the Labour conservative, it's a conservative sort of supported organisation. So Badenoch spoke at their last conference in February, and there's a couple of others as well. But Sir Paul Marshall, that name's ringing a bell. Legatum Institute, Alan McCormack. So I feel like I'm getting close to being able to provide enough evidence to trigger police arrest. And that's what I'm asking for in this current letter I'm just working on Lord Scriven. So it's Lord Scriven that's really brought the whole piece together, doing his compliance assessment. Because Lord Scriven has been working for, in his current register of interest, he's working for the Department of Public Service Management and the Government of Botswana. So the very customer that this story started out with.
Wow. Well, look, I mean, what you're describing is actually a fascist system. It's a system of economic and digital slavery.
Absolutely. And that is the intention. And I was told that by more than one of my colleagues. My colleague spoke very openly about what the longer term plans were, really. I didn't believe them.
Well, I mean, what would you suggest? We just throw away our computers or what?
All of our systems are infected by their needs. So that's needs, money, adulation, and young blood. So I'm fairly sure we could reverse engineer systems and remove the harm and leave ourselves with systems that can help us but don't control us. But it absolutely needs a global audit and dismantling the systems.
Yeah, well, maybe we should not be employing PricewaterhouseCoopers or KPMG to do that.
Well, absolutely not. No, they're criminal organisations. So PricewaterhouseCoopers, so as well as supplying the consultants into the government of Botswana, they were also our auditors. And if you look in IBM's annual report, even today, it says it loud and proud. PricewaterhouseCoopers has been IBM's auditor, has been honoured to be IBM's auditor for over 100 years.
God.
Yeah.
So where would you suggest just sort of the most interesting stuff this week people can find?
To look at my website, alisonwright.substack.com.
And have you got any closing comments from a sort of almost like spiritual point of view about all this?
I mean, the information I've just said, it rocked me. I was brought up Catholic, and I went to a convent and was practicing most of my life, my younger life, until I didn't have to. I believe that we're naturally good. And our systems have been captured by people who are committing crimes against natural law. And that's why a lot of the harm that we see in our world is happening. I'm certain we can stop it, absolutely certain. And we can do it through the law. I urge people to investigate, check who they've voted for, look their name up in Companies House. Do they have multiple identities? What are they associated to? If you find an issue, write a letter of complaint. It gives us more agency. And as the evidence builds, it'll become a tidal wave. It'll mean that we can clear out these criminals from our systems. Basically, yeah.
Where do people find this advice if people are interested in sort of lending a hand, Alison?
Well, I've been publishing it on Substack, Alison's newsletter, I think it's called, Industrial Revolutions. Some of this information I've just told you is written there. You'll have to find it. There's 100-something reports that I've published, and I've got another 100-odd that I haven't completed. But yes, you'll find information right there.
Sounds to me as if you have had a bit of a unique journey. Can you just remind us of the website again?
I wish I could. I think it's called www.alisonwright.substack.com.
Well, we can always use a search engine, not necessarily Google, to find it, because the algorithms are probably looking at your website and thinking we don't really want people finding this. Anyway, Alison, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thank you.